Welcome to Energy Stew. This is Peter Roth, your host. And this is going to be a very interesting show, maybe a difficult show, because it's about responsibility. It's a responsibility to where we live and who we live with. And as many people know, I'm interested in higher consciousness, in positive outlooks, and not sinking into the morass of the fear and craziness that goes on in the world, because then we become a part of it. But there is a point where we need to become a part of it, because we can't ignore our responsibilities to our fellow humans, and in this case, fellow Americans, because this is a problem that is facing America. And it's getting worse and worse and worse, to the point of it's going to become every. It already is everybody's problem. It's going to become worse and worse if we don't do something about it. So we really have to be responsible to make this a better world, to live forward in positive thinking and in being wiser and smarter in ways that are sometimes very hard to look at. So what we're going to look at now is the way that we handle prisons in America, or justice in America, or injustice in America, in ways that are boiling over and we can make better. It's not easy, and we can get there. With the help of the author of a book that I've just read and been amazed about how profound it is and important it is to understand this whole concept of American justice, or let's say American injustice. And the name of the book is Inferno, because it talks about the inferno that exists around us in this injustice system. And the author of this book is a very important person in the law environment. He's a professor at Columbia Law School and has also taught at Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Stanford, Chicago. He's been around, and he is somebody who I think we can all really listen to with a lot of respect and understanding that, and this book is amazing. He really has done a very impressive job. So I'm very happy to have as my guest on the show, Robert Ferguson. Robert, welcome.
Thank you. How are you, Peter?
Well, I'm fine. I'm a little anxious about the topic that we're talking about. To me, it's always amazing of the people who are regularly involved in the law, and the constant need to deal with trouble. And you know, you undertake a great responsibility to the world, to want to sink your teeth into justice and injustice. And your book is harrowing about the prison system, about what you call the punishment regime. And that's what we really need to look at, is why our country puts so many more people into jail than any other part of the world, by far. And for longer sentences and under much poorer conditions than exist in much of the, certainly of the Western world.
The figures are really quite staggering. We have 5% of the world's population and 25% of its prison population. Europe puts 95 out of 100,000 people in prison. We put 714 out of 100,000 in prison. We have 2 million people in prison. That's a population that's greater than New Hampshire and Vermont put together.
Well, let's talk about why this is true, because there's got to be a reason why we're so out of control. And because does it serve a greater purpose to be so out of control? Are we really serving the needs of the community to build bigger prisons that include more and more and harsher punishment?
Well, some of it, I think, is the perception of a general population of how much insecurity there is in our culture. Some of this comes from television shows, which always depict horrifying predators, sometimes from outer space, at our door. I think it's also a matter of a certain leveling impulse in the culture that democracy insists upon everyone being treated the same, so that if you have harsh sentences, it's very difficult for courts, given the status of our sentencing regimes, to differentiate between different people caught up in a criminal situation. I've just read an article in which a judge is protesting having to give a man 57 years in prison when others who have plea bargained and are more responsible for the crime that was committed received 6 years in prison. So the sentencing regime is part of the problem, but so is our cultural understanding of crime and what it means.
Well, we've created this sentencing regime by electing politicians who beat the drum for harsh penalties. And if they don't get elected. And so they're actually creating more crimes by putting new crimes in the books, inventing crime, so that there are more and more things that we have to, that we can get into trouble with. And then they also enact laws that create much harsher sentences and limit the judges to their ability to judge, to decide on lighter sentences, for instance, for what you just talked about. So there are a lot of reasons why we're all responsible for it.
I agree with that. The politicians would not speak in the way they do about being tough on crime if it didn't play well in the polling booth. So there's a need for us to understand what we're doing. I first decided to write this book when I discovered that I could give my law students a problem in prosecutorial discretion where they would argue very vehemently over the recommendation they would give to a judge, and it would go all the way from 6 months of house arrest to 20 years in prison on the same facts. So it taught me that we don't understand what we're doing when we punish people, and we certainly don't understand what our prisons are when we put somebody in them.
Well, that's a big part of your book, too, talking about how the system works on every level, because there are so many levels that create prisoners, from TV and victim testimony, which is a new thing that you talk about in the book that gets people even more and more riled up, the need to put minor criminals in front of the media in shackles and make them, you know, look like they've just murdered somebody. And there's so many ways that we instill fear and push people to want to punish harder.
Well, I think the other thing that people have to recognize fairly quickly is that the current system doesn't work. 60% of the people who are released from prisons and jails are back in prison within 3 years. So we're not doing anything to prepare people to return from prison to society in a way that would make them healthy, functioning, responsible citizens.
Well, very few prisons actually address prisoners in a positive manner, in a way that don't make them worse.
It's worse than that. There's sort of a ritual humiliation of prisoners by correction officers in such a way that you're dealing with people who already have problems and they're made to feel much worse about themselves. Now, I don't want to ignore the fact that there are people who are in prison who have to stay there. This culture does produce a percentage of predators that like to, or really hardened criminals. But that number is much, much smaller than television or general media reports would indicate.
And yet it's much larger in terms of the effect of it on the prison systems.
Exactly.
And so the prison system itself is very self-protective. The fact that it doesn't talk. Prisoners really have no rights to defend themselves. The courts have really not been very good at handling prisoners' complaints.
Well, if you're in court, or if you're accused of a crime and a prosecutor says, I'm going to give you a deal for 6 years for this, if you will plea bargain and accept it. But if you don't accept it and we go to trial, the stacked kinds of offenses that I can give you will put you in jail for 30 years. That's a situation that I think presumptively takes the right of trial away from a defendant. How could anyone take that chance, life in prison versus 6 years in prison? So the whole plea bargaining arrangement, which is a convenience, I think has created massive injustice in our system.
And yet once people are in prison, things happen to make their sentences even longer. Due to the capriciousness of the correction officers and all kinds of ways that prisoners can really harm each other.
Right. Well, within prison, what you have are two sides, essentially, correction officers and inmates, and our people in prison, as I prefer to call them. And even the courts describe this as a battle zone. Something must be done to improve the training of correction officers. A lot has to be done to improve prison conditions if we expect people to behave better than they do now in prison.
Well, it takes honesty, too, because it has to expose what's the truth about our prisons. And then there are prisons now that are called super prisons that don't expose anything. And what can you say about that?
Well, we have maximum security prisons now where people live in solitary confinement. We have 159,000 people serving life sentences now. That's a punishment that most European countries don't even have. And we put what we consider to be our worst offenders in these maximum security prisons, where they are in solitary cement bunkers and are not allowed to mix with other prisoners for years on end. I correspond with one prisoner who's been in solitary confinement for 7 years. It's almost impossible to imagine what that means. You might consider locking yourself in your bathroom for a day with nothing to do and think about what it means to be confined to a small space with nothing to do and no contact with any other person. But even that doesn't come close to what time in prison means. One of my feelings about this problem is that there are many experts in penology, but there are no experts on prisons except those people who are inside of them. And that's why we have to open consideration of what happens to people in prison in a different way. I think we have to change the whole language that we use in punishment to change what's happening.
Right. And that's the point, is that our fear at this point and our intransigence makes it very hard. So perhaps the only way to go about this is in increments through different groups that are like volunteer groups and not-for-profits. That I have friends who run a theater program in prisons to help prisoners learn new skills and have a more positive attitude, and it's very humanizing.
There is more awareness now than there was, in the sense of there are various kinds of programs that describe prisons on television. Oz was one, The Wire was another such program. So people are a little more aware. One of the problems is we like to dismiss people who have been convicted. The term jailbird applies to somebody who's been in prison, but even to somebody who's come out of prison. And it signifies somebody who's not allowed to fly. We have something like 580,000 people coming out of prison who aren't allowed to vote because they're previous felons. So we systematically look down on those people, not who commit crimes, but who are convicted of crimes.
And have served their sentence, and now they're done, and yet there's so many rights they don't have, not just voting, but they can't get student loans, for instance.
They're kicked out of public housing.
Right. There are so many things that they can't have, including jobs that most people won't hire them for because they have a record.
That's right. So one of the recommendations I've made has been to create really programs of work in prisons that will teach skills and that will give people a sense of development. It seems to me that even somebody who's in prison for life needs to develop in that environment in order to have even a minimal sense of health and cooperation.
A lot of people think that's already happening, that there are a lot of prisons that really enhance prison life and help prisoners learn skills and be able to move on. But you know, it's not as prevalent as people imagine.
It's not as prevalent, and it isn't as attuned to current work conditions as one would like. We've become a service industry in terms of our economy. So how do you train people to work with other people when you keep them in solitary confinement for any period of time in prison? People lose the skills or whatever skills they had when they entered prison for that reason. My feeling is very few people come out of prison better than when they enter. There are exceptions.
Right.
I correspond with some prisoners who have turned their lives around. But they've done it, I think, for the most part, against the pressures of prison rather than being helped by them. There are programs. But the programs themselves reach, I think, a small number of people in prison any meaningful way.
I think what we're seeing is something that we're now understanding as a result of soldiers coming back from war, and they suffer from post-traumatic stress syndrome. I would imagine almost anybody coming out of prison suffers from that same problem, and they might need a lot of support to be in support groups that work with post-traumatic stress syndrome.
There's, of course, another problem. Our prison system, jails and prisons together, now spend $80 billion a year on incarceration. We have 500,000 correction officers. One out of nine state employees works in penology in some kind of way. So this is a thriving domestic industry, and many people profit from it. We now have private prisons where people invest in them and receive money for holding people in jail.
Right,
and I
did a film on that called Kids for Cash, and there were two judges that were that had a stake in the private prison, so they were... this one judge in particular put 3,000 kids in this juvenile detention center that he had a stake in, And now he's in jail because these kids shouldn't have been in jail.
I mean, why should anyone make money off of someone in prison? I mean, I understand why prisons cost so much. Something like $167,000 a year for a prisoner in New York for a year. But it seems to me much of that money is poorly used, that there are ways in which you could improve the system in ways that might make a big difference.
We need a lot more wise people who don't understand that the system is intractable and that when they're in it, they have to play the game. It's more about wise people who really understand crime, who understand sentencing, who understand why people are in jail. There are so many people in jail for nonviolent reasons that are mixed with violent populations. And so the jails aren't run wisely.
Well, and the whole criminal justice system, with Anthony Kennedy in 2003 speaking to the American Bar Association, says that lawyers forget about their clients once they are in prison. This isn't true of everyone. There are many committed people working with people about appeals. But in general, people, once there is a conviction, they disappear into prison. I mean, inmate is a very telling word. It means that you are lost to outmate status, essentially. And there's a public feeling of satisfaction when a criminal is put away. I understand that. The question, though, then becomes, what do you do to make that person better than he or she was when they entered prison?
There's something about asking that question that takes an unusual person to be able to say that.
I mean, one has to realize that punishment is essentially about deprivation. You lose your freedom. That is what the law claims. You are sentenced to a period of time in prison. But that's all punishment should be. In other words, it should be the loss of your freedom. It shouldn't involve being raped in prison. It shouldn't involve being beaten by guards. It shouldn't involve various forms of humiliation that are now practiced as a matter of routine.
Well, in your book, you talk a lot about the concept of retribution.
I think retribution is a natural impulse in punishing. What one needs is a countervailing understanding. The current word used for that is rehabilitation, but I don't think it's a word that really captures what's really at stake. What one really wants to talk about, I think, is restoring people, of making them better than they were. Most criminals, not all, come from very troubled backgrounds where they've had very little help, very little support. Many turn to crime as the only way of making a living in many areas. We need to answer those problems. It's asking a lot of a prison system to do that. But they do have this captive population. It is possible to train people. It is possible to teach people. It is possible to give them skills that will make them different than when they entered.
And to have guidance of these people performing these skills. And that's where I think it gets lost at this point. And the unions,
let me say just a word about prison guards, since I find that many of them act negatively. No one grows up wanting to be a correction officer. Correction officers also are injured more frequently than most people who are in work. They have a shorter life expectancy. The conditions under which they work are terrible because of overcrowding. No one is happy with the current prison system, in my view. The question is, how do you turn that general unhappiness into a solution?
Well, that's the ongoing discussion, and that's where the recalcitrance shows up, because not everybody wants to be in this discussion, and so it takes a book like this, and you being out there talking about it to
push people.
Well,
it was certainly a book written for a general American population, but also for professional people to understand what they're doing. One of the things I argue in the book is that each stage of the process is necessarily separate for justice. You don't want the police officer who is arresting to be on the jury. You don't want the prosecutor to be a witness. So the situation is carefully divided to ensure justice, that no one person plays more than one role within the legal system at a time. Unfortunately, that also means that no one person accepts responsibility for the final thing that happens.
So everybody
can
play
part of the problem.
Right, they can play their role and then turn their back and say, I've done my job.
Everyone plays their role and then turns their back on the problem. And what's interesting is that everyone, I think, now realizes the problem is out of control. Our prisons are too crowded to really help the people that are in them. That's because of the severe sentences, the length of the sentences, and the lack of early release. Parole is a very difficult thing to accomplish in many state systems. There have been some changes in the federal system of late, but the federal system is very small compared to the state penal system. And that's where the major problems really lie.
So, well, it's a systemic problem in general in this country of all of these factors that play into it, including the politicians, the media, and just the unions, for instance, for correction officers. there's a lot of obstacles out there that don't want change. And so we're getting near the end of the show, and I want to bring people back to why we're talking about this, other than that it's an important subject matter, but it's because you have an important book called Inferno that really is amazingly enriched with detail, historical as well as current, and also your understandings of how we might be able to change the system and make it a better world for all of us.
One thing that I think people can take from this show is they shouldn't listen to a political figure who talks about tough on crime. We are already tougher on crime than we need to be, demonstrably. That kind of language should be resisted at the polls. It's one thing that everyone could do who is a citizen.
Well, it's just the promotion of fear and keeping that fear talk going. And the media doesn't help, because it keeps showing us things to be fearful about. So we need to talk about that, too, and let everybody understand how to separate, to be more objective and to understand this very objectively. Not be caught up in it. And so this is wonderful that we could talk about this and let the audience know about the book Inferno. Your name is Robert Ferguson. Where can they go to find out more?
Well, there are a number of books on this subject. My full title is Inferno, An Anatomy of American Punishment. But there are many books written on this subject. There are many the facts that I gave you earlier about the number of people in prison are readily available on the Internet. People can inform themselves, I think, through that. They can also understand that empathy for another person should extend beyond their immediate understanding.
Right, right. Empathy is hard to come by for a lot of people in this country, as research has shown.
I think not. I think people generally show empathy for the people who are around them.
Yes, yes. But we're looking at empathy for things that they might be afraid of, and they can open up and learn more about it. Robert Ferguson, we have to end the show, so I want to thank you so much for
thank you for having me, Peter.
And you and I cross paths in our workouts in the morning. I'm looking forward to seeing you again soon. And I really appreciate you being a guest on Energy Stew. And this is Peter Roth, your host of Energy Stew at PRN.FM. I can be reached at peter@heartriver.org. And 212-222-7748. Please call me with questions or email me or whatever. I'd like to hear from you. And thank you so much for listening.